Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today with us, Dennis Goldford, professor and chair of political science at Drake University in our Des Moines studio. Dennis, good to have you.
Always glad to be here, Ben.
Chris Larimer is with us in our Cedar Falls studio, associate professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Ben.
We wanted to start off the hour with our governor becoming the next U.S. ambassador to China, talking about some of the implications for that. Also, the transition to future Governor Kim Reynolds. Of course, the twists and turns in Washington on the budget deal. Also, a lot of movement in the news that we're watching on the replacement for the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, to see if the Republicans can make good on that campaign promise. And also some words from Hillary Clinton in the first major interview she's had since the loss in November. And, of course, we hear the hearings with James Comey of the FBI, too, to talk about. But let's start off, gentlemen, with our governor, poised for confirmation as U.S. ambassador to China. After a two-hour hearing yesterday, members of both parties praised his performance, his understanding of the issues ranging from human rights violations to intellectual property theft. At his confirmation hearing before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee yesterday, he was asked about how he would work with China as U.S. ambassador to deal with the threat of North Korea.
There's no way that China is going to want to see a regime change that has a democratic united Korea under South Korean rule on their border. By the same token, I think we also recognize that Seoul is very close. I mean, I've been to Seoul several times, South Korea. I've been to the DMZ. I think 20 million people in Seoul whose lives are in jeopardy if we were to try to attack North Korea. That's certainly not something we want to put those people's lives in jeopardy. So that's why working with the Chinese and convincing the Chinese that they are the ones that have the potential to really influence the regime in North Korea more than anyone else, and that the change that needs to take place there doesn't need to be a threat to the system, but needs to stop this nuclear proliferation and the building of a guidance system for missiles to attack the United States and Japan and other countries in the world. It is probably the most pressing issue that we have right now. And I want to do whatever I can to try to be a go-between between our two countries that can help convince the leadership in China that it's in their interest and our interest to work together to stop this dangerous direction that is coming out of North Korea. And their leadership is critically important to doing that, and it needs to be done in a way that they don't feel it threatens them, but also that it will provide security to the other nations in that part of the world.
Okay, our current governor, the future U.S. ambassador to China, Terry Branstad, there talking about to be thrown into one of the highest tension areas or issues, rather, in the world. Dennis, what actually can a U.S. ambassador to do, and an ambassador like Terry Branstad with his connections to China?
I think there are two things we have to bear in mind. The first is that until perhaps the last 50, 60 years or so, when communications weren't as good and as instantaneous, I think ambassadors tended to have a little bit more flexibility, a little bit more freedom. They might have some general marching orders from the State Department, from the White House in terms of what U.S. policies might be. And then they had, I think, some time and flexibility to conduct diplomacy, if you will. But I think over the past 50, certainly over the past 40 or 30 years even, in terms of relationships with in really key countries in American foreign policy, More and more has been run not even out of the State Department, but out of the White House. And ambassadors are there dealing with sort of practical everyday matters, but the real direction and the real negotiation tends to come from the White House, from national security advisors, maybe from a Secretary of State. That's the first point. The second is that, as I've said, I believe, before, that while Governor Branstad has a long history with the current president of China and seems to get along well with him, they seem to like and respect each other, the Chinese are tough, realistic practitioners of foreign policy. And I don't think that they would change any particular national interest of ours in order to placate or please the president's good friend, Terry Branstad.
Mm-hmm. Chris, tell us a little bit about how you see Branstad fitting into this new role as U.S. ambassador to China with his background.
Well, I think, you know, what's been fascinating to watch is how much that role might change or has changed. You know, when President Trump initially indicated that Governor Branstad would be his choice for ambassador to China, I think since that time, these last 3 to 4 months, we've seen, a tremendous escalation on the issue with North Korea. And so what you saw yesterday in the hearing was, while it was relatively uneventful, there was a lot of discussion about how to balance sort of Terry Branstad's personal relationship with the president of China while also taking a tough stand on issues that we've tried, that the United States has tried to take a tough stand on with China in terms of human rights, trade, intellectual property rights, but at the same time also reaching out to China to help in terms of dealing with the situation with North Korea. So I think, you know, the initial choice of Governor Branstad was obviously based on the personal relationship that he had established with President Xi of China. But as Dennis said, that will only go so far. And the relationship with China has become increasingly more complicated since President Trump indicated Governor Branstad would be his choice for ambassador. And you saw that at the hearing, senators trying to understand how Governor Branstad would balance all of these issues in terms of being tough on traditional policy issues that the United States needs to be tough on with regards to China, but then also reaching out in terms of cooperation. And how do you do that when you have a personal relationship with the president of China?
Mm-hmm. Dennis, to you on this point, you have to wonder what the Chinese are thinking about how our new president operates. For instance, his about face on China. We to quote him from his campaign, calling China the grand champions of currency manipulation, and also claiming that China was, quote, raping our country, to where we are now, where he sees we need China to possibly remedy the North Korea situation. Is that all something in the past, or the Chinese perhaps the type of people to, I don't know, do they see that as for domestic consumption and not really pointed at them?
Well, I can't remember which famous diplomat said this a long time ago, but the realist approach to foreign policy and diplomacy is we have no permanent friends, we have permanent interests. And I think that's the case with the Chinese. Now, the U.S., interestingly, always had an attitude toward China almost as a little brother we were going to take care of. Hence the vitriol of the so-called "who lost China" debate in the late 1940s and into the 1950s. But that being said, Donald Trump likes to talk about the madman theory, which is that the president, if he's unpredictable, means that other countries would be very cautious about crossing the U.S. because they don't know what the president might do in any particular circumstance. Well, is that workable or not? It goes in some ways back to Richard Nixon. But, Nixon did know substantive things about foreign policy, and Mr. Trump has not yet demonstrated any kind of in-depth knowledge about foreign policy. He makes various sorts of incendiary claims. That seems to be his modus operandi. And then when the terms shift and you need the other guys, all of a sudden you're much more willing to placate them and do what you need to enlist their support.
Mm-hmm. Chris, when we talk about Branstad and Trump, both Republicans but of a different sort, how well do Branstad's politics reflect the vision of Donald Trump? Or does that even matter in the role of U.S. ambassador?
Well, that's difficult to say. I think, in terms of the politics of the two individuals, they both practice or preach their ability to be relatable to the average voter, and you know that they can understand the concerns of ordinary Americans. That's something that you see in poll after poll. That's something that we've seen over the last 10 to 20 years, where Americans feel more and more disconnected with elected officials, that the elected officials are out of touch with their interests. And so I think both Governor Branstad during his time as governor and certainly Donald Trump during this last campaign tapped into that sentiment to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, going forward, as Dennis said, as ambassador, Terry Branstad is going to be beholden to the Trump administration and the policy interests that
right.
President Trump is looking for.
Here are the marching orders. You carry them out, more or less.
Yeah, exactly. And I think to the earlier conversation, though, in yesterday's hearing, you know, Senator Menendez, I think, kind of got at the main issue there. He asked Governor Branstad if he considers China an ally or an adversary. And I think that really gets at the main issue right now, is that there are clear disagreements with China on a number of issues, but there's also the issue of North Korea. And so how do you balance those two things? And how do you think of China as an ally or an adversary? And we've heard President Trump sort of talk about China as both.
Governor Branstad, I think, was very well prepared for his hearings yesterday. Somebody did a lot of work with him, mm-hmm. and he showed some knowledge on things that we might not have expected him to know. But that being said, I think the chief danger for Governor Branstad is he could be pursuing one line of discussion, negotiation, one line of policy with the Chinese, and then somebody in the Trump administration could well reverse course and pull the rug out from under him, leaving him exposed as not really knowing what's going on and not really in control.
The Trump administration doing something unpredictable, you're saying, Dennis?
Yeah, you can predict the unpredictable for the administration.
Dennis Goldford of Drake University with us, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa. Politics Wednesday is talking about our governor, soon to be, barring something unforeseen, soon to be U.S. ambassador to China, our embassy in China, the largest U.S. embassy in the world, I understand. And let me throw in this. We have an event tonight. I'll be co-moderating a discussion hosted by the University of Iowa Public Policy Center, the Des Moines Register, and Iowa Public Radio. Lynn Hicks of the Des Moines Register will be joining me, co-moderating a discussion with former U.S. Ambassadors Mary Kramer and Ron McMillan, along with Bill Niebuhr, who is of the company Origin Agritech. Also, a political science professor, Wang Fong Tang, will be talking in depth about China, Iowa, and diplomacy in the Trump administration beginning at 7 o'clock. It's open and free to the public at Shambaugh Auditorium on the University of Iowa campus, and we'll broadcast an edited version of that tomorrow over the noon hour here on River to River. Well, Lieutenant Governor Kim Reynolds is poised to become the first female governor of Iowa as Governor Branstad moves to his ambassadorship. She sat down with IPR's Clay Masters to talk about the transition and the recent opinion from the Iowa Attorney General, Tom Miller, that she is not constitutionally authorized to appoint a new lieutenant governor.
Because the governor asked, when he asked me if I would be his running mate, he said we're going to run as a team and serve as a team. And so I've been involved in all aspects of the executive branch, whether that is putting forth policy, leading initiatives. I've led trade missions. I've been in on the judicial appointments, just boards and commissions, all aspects. And so because of that, Iowans expect a seamless transition, a peaceful transition, and I feel very comfortable that we're going to be able to deliver that to Iowans. But again, I think they believe that we should have a governor and a lieutenant governor, and that was clear. And it should be part of the executive branch, and that was made clear, I think, when we changed the Constitution in 1988.
You talk about how you and the governor have been a team. For the last 5 years that I have been in Iowa, I can rarely think of a public event where you have not been by his side. Are there times that you have respectfully disagreed with the governor?
Well, yeah, and you know, I'm looking for that same type. I want an individual that is compatible and that's an idea person that's, you know, thinks outside of the box and looks for ways that we can do something different. And I want somebody that philosophically aligns with me, but is not afraid to say, well, I think we should maybe, what about this? Or how about this individual? And that's what I've had the good fortune. That's the kind of relationship that Governor Branstad and I have had, and I want to continue that same type of partnership.
What's an example of when you and the governor disagreed?
Well, you know, the great opportunity when you have somebody that gives you the opportunity to do that is if you do disagree, we do it in a closed environment where we can have a healthy discussion.
You're not going to tip your hand?
And he's still the governor, and so, you know, he's the governor, and I respect that. And but I have every opportunity to weigh in, to make my case. We agree almost, you know, a lot, but we've come down on some different sides on judicial appointments is one example where I would have maybe gone a different direction than the governor, and I've had the opportunity to say why and to talk, to make my case, and so I appreciate that very much.
Lieutenant Governor Kim Reynolds speaking with Clay Masters of Iowa Public Radio. You can hear that entire interview. It's over 20 minutes long by going to iowapublicradio.org. Chris, perhaps you can introduce us a little more to our next governor, Iowa's first female governor, though she's been in the background a long time. I'm sure a lot of Iowans just don't really know her quite yet.
Well, I think as far as getting to know Iowans, the question that, or the statement that Clay posed as far as Lieutenant Governor Reynolds being at nearly every event with Governor Branstad the last 6 years, I think that's key for soon, assuming she will take over as governor here shortly, for soon to be Governor Reynolds. I think that's key for her in terms of being out in front of Iowans. You know, my understanding, some of the research I've done on Iowa governors is that personal aspect matters, and it certainly does for a lot of other races. It matters in other states as well. But the Iowans seem to want to be able to see and get a chance to see these candidates up close. And so if Governor Reynolds, and she has been doing this the last 6 years where she's out and about, she's at numerous events, both big and small, you know, trying to increase her profile among Iowans, those things matter. I mean, you know, when we think about governors, we generally know that, you know, politics matters. Is your party at the time particularly popular? Do you share party affiliation with an unpopular president? And it looks like in the case of Lieutenant Governor Reynolds that she probably will share party affiliation with an unpopular president going into an election year. The economics of the state matter. You know, is the state going in the right direction? Do citizens see it going in the right direction? Is the state's unemployment rate, you know, trending in the right direction? And so on economics, you know, I think you can make the argument that the state is somewhat trending in the right direction. But in terms of politics, the view of the Republican Party, or at least being associated at all with President Trump, is going to be to Lieutenant Governor Reynolds' disadvantage going into 2018. So the way to break that balance is through a personal relationship. And so if she's been out there as often as has been documented, you know, I think that's going to give her a little bit of leeway going into 2018. Now, the issue of as far as, you know, essentially occupying both the lieutenant governor's office and the governor's office based on the attorney general's ruling yesterday, that's just incredibly, you know, unusual. It's not unusual in the sense that there's precedent for it, because that has happened in the past, but the length of time with which she will be occupying both offices, that's going to be a bit unusual going forward.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, your observations as we look forward to this transition to future Governor Kim Reynolds.
Well, leaving the constitutional question aside that perhaps we can get to, you know, in the interview with Clay, Lieutenant Governor Reynolds, only at the end of the snippets you played, suggested where she might have had a disagreement with the governor, and she simply referred to judicial appointments. We don't really know the substance of that. So as far as anybody knows, because she's talked about any disagreement being behind closed doors, she's basically been a clone of Terry Branstad. Some years ago when she first became lieutenant governor, if I recall correctly, an Iowa columnist, rather with a certain wickedly clever phrasing, referred to her as Iowa's highest paid intern. And she's an extremely charming person. She's done various trade missions. Chris says, she's had various kinds of personal connections which are important to Iowans. But at this point, we really don't know who Kim Reynolds is in terms of policy orientation. I have heard her at various Republican events and in speeches she's given there. At times, she sounded as if she were trying to be Iowa's own Sarah Palin in terms of her position on various issues with kind of a Tea Party and orientation and a concern for the issues that animate religious conservatives, Christian conservatives, particularly in Iowa. But otherwise, it's hard to know at this point who she is, and this will be a period of exploration and self-revelation when she does take over the office.
Talk a little bit about this Attorney General ruling. Tom Miller ruling that she should not appoint a lieutenant governor in her place. Dennis, what does that matter? We have this constitutional question. There is also the political consequence of being able to have a lieutenant governor, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, I preface this by saying I'm not at all an expert in Iowa constitutional law, although I teach American constitutional law at times. But I'll note, first of all, that the phrase that she will occupy both positions simultaneously, is at best inartful and at worst simply wrong. You can't, in this case, occupy both offices, I don't believe. But the question is this. Yes, by statute, the Iowa legislature seems to have given the governor the power to appoint a lieutenant governor. But the question is whether the Iowa Constitution gives the legislature the authority to pass such a statute to begin with. And in my cursory look at the Iowa Constitution, there seems to be simply no mention of what happens if you have a vacancy in the lieutenant governor's position. There's all the talk is about if there's a vacancy in the governor's office, in which case the lieutenant governor replaces the governor, and if for some reason there's a vacancy in both, there are various procedures for providing some leadership for the state. But there's simply, again, as I read the constitutional provision at issue, there's simply no statement that the governor would have this power. Now, absent a statement, does that mean that the governor doesn't have the power, but the legislature is authorized to fill in the blank, so to speak? Or does the fact that there's nothing mentioned at all in the Iowa Constitution mean that nobody has that power? It's simply not covered. We don't know at this point. That's what may go before the Supreme Court in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. And then the thought here, too, is that supposing Kim Reynolds appoints a lieutenant governor, then for some reason she could not serve out her term. We would have a lieutenant governor elevated perhaps to governor, and we would have a governor who was never elected to that position.
Remember that as of from November 22nd of 1963 to January 20th of 1965, we had no vice president of the United States. Lyndon Johnson was the president. Because the next in line, the Speaker of the House, was John McCormick from Massachusetts, who was about 750 years old, that made everybody nervous about the line of succession. That's why we got the 25th Amendment, which provides for how that would work. But that would require confirmation by both houses of Congress. Here we may be talking about simply a governmental appointment in which there's no political accountability or no check on the powers government, the governor's power to appoint someone. That's what's in question.
Stay with us. Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, Politics Wednesday. When we come back, I see movement in the news on the Affordable Care Act, the repeal and replacement. We'll talk about that when we return. Also avoiding that shutdown and an interesting interview that Donald Trump had with John Dickerson of CBS. We'll be back in just a minute. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River. And we're back with more of this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Just a reminder, I'd hope to see you tonight at 7 p.m. at Shambaugh Auditorium in Iowa City. I'll be co-moderating a panel discussion with Lynn Hicks of the Des Moines Register. We'll be talking with former U.S. Ambassadors Mary Kramer, Ron McMullen, as well as hearing from international business and political perspectives, China, Iowa, and diplomacy in the Trump administration, an event this evening, 7 p.m. in Shambaugh Auditorium in Iowa City on the University of Iowa campus. It's open to the public, and it's a nice auditorium, plenty of room, I'm sure. We're talking today with Dennis Goldford of Drake University, where he's professor and chair of the Political Science Department, Chris Larimer, the associate professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Of course, it's Politics Wednesday, chewing over the plenty on our plate to survey on the political landscape. We've been hearing in the last few minutes the news as we sort of pivot to the Affordable Care Act and the Republicans' attempt to come back from a first failed attempt at repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. The latest news within the last couple of hours, two prominent Republicans who had said they would oppose the Paul Ryan health care bill say they've negotiated stronger protections for those with pre-existing conditions and will now back the bill. Congressman Billy Long from Missouri, Fred Upton from Michigan, reversed their course this morning. House leaders have said they may push for a vote as early as Thursday. Early indications are that the amendment negotiated with President Trump could also sway some moderates in support of the bill. So the White House in full court press to rally GOP support to repeal and replace Obamacare. Dennis, what are your thoughts as we see these continued attempts?
The Trump administration, especially President Trump, has been very concerned to have something they could consider a victory, an accomplishment. And they talked, for example, about his great accomplishment in getting Justice Gorsuch confirmed. But there was no heavy lifting there. The Republicans were bound and determined to support him, and they abolished the filibuster, at least in that particular instance, for a Supreme Court nominee. So it's not that Mr. Trump actually did anything. In this particular case, by the accounts I read, he did agree. He talked to Representative Long and Representative Upton and did agree to push for a certain increased amount of money to be used for high-risk pools. That would be actual presidential involvement in a piece of legislation. It's still jump ball whether this gets through the House or not, but if it gets through the House with approval, that would be an accomplishment for Mr. Trump. But that doesn't mean at this point that it would get through the Senate. So
right,
certainly have the ability.
And talk about that. The Senate, the politics of the Senate are a little bit different than the House.
Well, in the Senate, as people know, to avoid a filibuster, you need to have 60 votes. So even if you have 52 votes, 53 votes, whatever it might be, to pass a piece of legislation, if the Senate doesn't agree actually to bring up the matter because of a filibuster, you can't do anything. So that's why people always talk about needing 60 votes in the Senate. The Republicans have 52 votes at the moment. Now, there's this technical detail called reconciliation. If you're going to do something that's revenue neutral with regard to a piece of legislation, it doesn't increase the amount of money the federal government's taking in or decrease the amount of money the federal government's taking in. It's not subject to filibuster. You can do it by simple majority rule. But if there's a substantial change in the revenue aspect of any particular policy, like Obamacare, then you need 60 votes, and Democrats are bound and determined not to support any kind of change. So Republicans can't succeed without Democratic support in that regard.
Mm-hmm. So the Democrats can sit back, or are they taking any action that we can see here besides saying we're not on board here?
That's right. They're basically saying, hey, you guys are the majority. You try to run it, but we're going to stick by the rules that are in play at this point, and we're going to use the rules just as you did the last time around when we were in charge of things. We're going to use the rules as best we can.
I want to get your reaction to this, Dennis and Chris, as well. I don't know if you saw this, but it's a viral video that's been making the rounds that has to do with the Affordable Care Act. Late night TV host Jimmy Kimmel this week opened his show with an emotional monologue. It ran over 10 minutes that told the story of the recent birth of his son. And after an uneventful delivery of his son, a nurse noticed that the baby was purple. Further tests revealed a congenital heart defect that resulted in open heart surgery just hours after the birth of Jimmy Kimmel's son. Now, Kimmel made an emotional plea to his audience at the end of this 10 or 12 minute talk to put politics aside when it comes to health care. Let's listen.
We were brought up to believe that we live in the greatest country in the world, but until a few years ago, millions and millions of us had no access to health insurance at all. You know, before 2014, if you were born with congenital heart disease like my son was, there was a good chance you'd never be able to get health insurance because you had a pre-existing condition. You were born with a pre-existing condition. If your parents didn't have medical insurance, you might not live long enough to even get denied because of a pre-existing condition. If your baby is going to die, and it doesn't have to, it shouldn't matter how much money you make. I think that's something that, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat or something else, we all agree on that, right? I mean, we do. We need to make sure that the people who are supposed to represent us, the people who are meeting about this right now in Washington, understand that very clearly. Let's stop with the nonsense. This isn't football. There are no teams. We are the team. It's the United States. Don't let their partisan squabbles divide us on something every decent person wants. We need to take care of each other.
Okay, Jimmy Kimmel, part of a monologue he held that was much longer as well. I don't know if either of you saw this, but it's just an interesting intersection of cultural, what's happening, forming public opinion here, not just talks about politics, but when you tune into a comedian in the evening, this can happen. I don't know. Thoughts on this, Chris?
Yeah, I did see that the other night, and it is a very emotional speech, and it's hard to watch and not get emotional yourself, but you know, a couple of things on this point. One, in terms of agenda setting and public policy, You know, in the past, we've talked about things, what we would call focusing events, whether it's public opinion, a public opinion poll, an event, an image. We often talked about things that could suddenly shift public opinion and engage elected officials and, you know, lead to significant policy change. I think we are increasingly getting away from that possibility. You know, we've seen, and just as a few anecdotes, you know, we've seen horrible images coming out of Syria of children, whether it's the child on the beach in Turkey or children being put into ambulances. And we saw very little movement on the issue with Syria. We've seen this increasingly with other issues as well regarding humanitarian intervention, where we see these awful images or we hear these emotional testimonies, but we see absolutely no movement on public policy. So, you know, I'm actually increasingly less optimistic that these types of things can actually lead to policy change. Mm-hmm. And I think part of it is, you know, it deals with it relates to the increasing partisanship in the United States. I mean, we've seen poll after poll showing that, you know, Democrats and Republicans not only disagree with one another, but they actually have resentment toward the other party.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I would also say, but what's interesting here with the healthcare issue is that you're seeing the healthcare debate, the American Healthcare Act, and now version two of it, being debated on precisely the portion or the provision within the bill that is the most popular, and that's on pre-existing conditions. And that's what's puzzling is that Republicans seem to be debating on this. I saw, you know, Twitter is used so often now, I'm going to cite Twitter here, but a political scientist tweeted out this morning looking at the Republicans who were coming out against the Health Care Act and looking at the ideology of those Republicans who are against the version one of the American Health Care Act and version two. The ones who are against version one were on the more conservative end. The ones who are against version two now are a little bit less conservative. And the debate right now is on pre-existing conditions and whether or not states can opt out of that. And what's happening is that you're seeing Republicans struggling with how to deal with this. And it's bizarre that they're having the debate over the most popular provision of the bill.
I wonder if this indicates, and Dennis, tell us your thoughts here, if the ACA is repealed and replaced, that by the debate that's going on now, pre-existing conditions backed by President Trump covering those pre-existing conditions, access to health care, that the whole ACA has moved the ball down the field in the direction of those who want, I guess, health care to be more of a right than a privilege.
I think to some extent it has. That's why Republicans were so nervous about the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare, that if it were passed to begin with and people got used to it, they were concerned, I think, not that it would fail. They were concerned they opposed it because they thought it might succeed. There is, and your last comment referred to it, there's a fundamental philosophical debate as gripping a kind of television as the Kimmel video was. There's a fundamental philosophical debate. Republicans generally, not all, see health care as a commodity. I wouldn't say a privilege, but a commodity. For example, if I can't afford a car, I can't go into a dealership and say, well, I need a car and the government should help me buy the car. A car is a commodity that I can either afford or not afford. And Republicans see health care that way. Generally speaking, Democrats increasingly see health care as a right of citizenship. In other words, if the police or the firemen come to your house because you've got a problem, they don't ask, first of all, can you afford our services? You have this as a right of citizenship. And Democrats, generally speaking, not everyone, tend to see health care, or at least health insurance as a means to ensure health care, as a kind of right of citizenship that everybody should have regardless of ability to pay. And we have a kind of middle position, as I understand it. I believe there's a federal law that says, for example, if you're in a terrible accident or if you have to be rushed to an emergency room, that ER has to treat you and not even ask about ability to pay. Because if any hospital receives any kind of federal funds, they have to treat any and all people that come to the ER, regardless of ability to pay. But of course, the problem is, do they have to eat those costs? And that's where Democrats will say, you're already paying for people who don't have health insurance by increased costs for yourself. So that's why they say that we should have everybody required to have health insurance in some way so that the actual cost structure is more fair. So that's the basic debate. And the Kimmel video, however gripping it was, and I think it was very gripping, doesn't really solve that.
Dennis Goldford is with us of Drake University. Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa for another 10 minutes or so. We want to get to a couple of other things. I want to pay a couple of voices. Hillary Clinton, we haven't heard much from her in the past few months since the November election. At an appearance at the Women for Women International event in New York yesterday, Hillary Clinton told CNN's Christian Amanpour that the relaunch of the investigation into her email just days before the election was the main reason she lost.
It wasn't a perfect campaign. There is no such thing. But I was on the way to winning until the combination of Jim Comey's letter on October 28th and Russian WikiLeaks raised doubts in the minds of people who were inclined to vote for me but got scared off. And the evidence for that intervening event is, I think, compelling, persuasive. And so we overcame a lot in the campaign. We overcame an enormous barrage of negativity, of false equivalency, and so much else. But as Nate Silver, who, doesn't work for me, he's an independent analyst, but one considered to be very reliable, has concluded, if the election had been on October 27th, I'd be your president.
Okay, Hillary Clinton in an appearance with CNN's Christian Amanpour. Couple that, those words with these words. Testifying before the Senate Judiciary Oversight Committee today, FBI Director James Comey says he was faced with a horrible choice when his staff notified him that they had found additional Clinton emails from the beginning of her time as Secretary of State after he had told Congress that the investigation was closed.
To restart in a hugely significant way, potentially finding the emails that would reflect on her intent from the beginning and not speak about it would require an act of concealment, in my view. And so I stared at speak and conceal. Speak would be really bad. There's an election in 11 days. Lordy, that would be really bad. Concealing, in my view, would be catastrophic, not just to the FBI, but well beyond. And honestly, as between really bad and catastrophic, I said to my team, we've got to walk into the world of really bad. I've got to tell Congress that we're restarting this, not in some frivolous way, in a hugely significant way.
Okay, what do you think of those perspectives, Dennis Goldford, from Hillary Clinton and James Comey, as we look back to 2016 in that campaign and election?
Mrs. Clinton still seems incapable of acknowledging how poor a candidate she was and how poor a campaign she ran. Yes, in a close race, a feather, I always say, in any kind of close race, a feather on the scale makes the difference. So you can make that claim, to be sure. But in one way, it never should have been that close. Hillary Clinton was the one candidate among the Democrats that I think that Donald Trump could have beaten. The problem was Donald Trump was the only candidate among the Republicans that Hillary Clinton could have beaten because of her weaknesses, and she didn't do it. And the key factor I would mention with regard to her claim about as of October 27th she was going to win, and Chris, correct me if I'm wrong, I think we knew here in Iowa by certainly by early October, if not by late September, that Iowa, a state that had gone Democratic in every one of the last six presidential elections, was going to go for Trump. It was lost to Hillary Clinton. That should have been a flashing red light that something serious was wrong with the Clinton campaign, and that was several weeks, if not a month, before the Comey testimony.
Yeah, and I would add, just to pick up on what Dennis was saying, I think Clinton's comments assume several things for which there's really not a lot of empirical support, right? One is that that voter persuasion is possible, that voters were waiting, that they're, and really this is the other factor as well, is that there are late deciders, that voters could be persuaded by something the FBI director said, and that they were waiting until that late in October to make a choice between two very, very different candidates. And the third part of it is, that she also assumes that the polls were right. What we've seen since Election Day is that polling was off in rural areas. There was a lot more racial resentment in the electorate than we had previously assumed, and that she could pick off some GOP voters from the party. And it turns out GOP voters went back to their own party. They voted for Republicans at the same rate that they normally do. And so I think her statement that she could have won had the election been held a week or two earlier, I just don't see a lot of evidence to support that.
About 5 minutes left in our discussion. I wanted to play one more clip here and have your both of your reactions to it. It's an interesting exchange between CBS's John Dickerson and President Trump that had abruptly ended an Oval Office interview with CBS's John Dickerson. Here is John Dickerson repeatedly asking about the characterization of President Obama when speaking about surveillance.
You know, words are less important to me than deeds. And you saw what happened with surveillance, and everybody saw what happened with surveillance.
Difficulties how?
I thought that, well, you saw what happened with surveillance, and I think that was inappropriate.
What does that mean, sir?
You can figure that out yourself.
Well, the reason I asked is you said you called him sick and bad.
Look, you can figure it out yourself. He was very nice to me with words, and when I was with him, but after that there has been no relationship.
But you stand by that claim about him?
I don't stand by anything. I just, you can take it the way you want. I think our side's been proven very strongly, and everybody's talking about it. And frankly, it should be discussed. I think that is a very big surveillance of our citizens. I think that's a very big topic, and it's a topic that should be number one, and we should find out what the hell is going on.
I just wanted to find out, though, you're the president of the United States. You said he was sick and bad because he had tapped you.
You can take it any way you want.
But I'm asking you, because you don't want it to be fake news. I want to hear it from President Trump.
Me. You don't have to ask me.
Why not?
Because I have my own opinions. You can have your own opinions.
But I want to know your opinions. You're the president of the United States.
That's enough. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
President Trump waving away CBS's John Dickerson, returning to sit behind his desk in the Oval Office. I'm sure you both have seen this video here. A very strange exchange. We have just a minute or couple minutes left. So, Chris, why don't you lead off here? What do you make of this? I mean,
I think the danger is reading too much into it. I mean, This is just a series of bizarre statements that, you know, in public opinion, we often talk about top-of-the-head considerations. These just seem to be top-of-the-head statements that are sort of jumbled together. And, you know, it just seems to be whatever he's thinking about at the time to deflect to another conversation. And I think trying to understand that thinking is just, you know, in some ways a waste of time.
Mm-hmm. You could see this as badgering of the president, or you could be on John Dickerson's side and say, hey, these are answers you need to legitimately answer, Dennis.
We have a constitutional problem in the country in that there is no constitutionally required way for members of Congress to question the president. In Britain, of course, I think it's every Wednesday, they have question time when the prime minister has to stand in the House of Commons and submit to and respond to questions from the other party, from the opposition. We have nothing like that. The closest we have is the president taking questions from the press, acting on behalf of the American people, supposedly. But Congress can't force the president to talk to them. And that raises problems at various times. When you want to find out what the president is arguing and claiming and believing and thinking, it's left to journalists to try to find that out, because constitutionally, members of Congress have no way to do that. And that's tremendously problematic.
Mm-hmm. Here, not so much the concentration here, the focus on the sick and bad words used in Donald Trump's description of President Obama in a tweet some time ago. But here we still have President Trump maintaining that the wiretapping existed despite U.S. intelligence consensus to the contrary, right, Dennis?
Well, you know, he has a habit, or thus far seems to have a habit, of saying whatever's on his mind and what he wants to say. And he quite often, and this may be from his days as a deal maker, uses words for effect in order to achieve his objective of winning or a deal or dominating the other person. Language has meaning and consequence, but I think for him that's secondary to the effect he gets from using language in various ways.
Okay. I think we have to end this hour. It's been pleasant, fascinating to be with both of you, Dennis Goldford of Drake University and Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, picking over the latest on the political landscape. Thank you both for coming into our studios today.
You
Thank
bet.
Thank you very much.
Another reminder that this evening, an event that I'll be co-hosting with Lynn Hicks of the Des Moines Register, China, Iowa, and Diplomacy in the Trump Administration, free and open to the public at Shambaugh Auditorium on the University of Iowa campus, starts at 7 p.m. Would hope to see you there, an edited version of that panel discussion, including two former U.S. ambassadors, will be aired tomorrow at this time. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Ben Stanton, and Lindsay Moon, with help from Chelsea Hoy. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.